I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
You know, it's always a pleasure.
Thinking back over earlier podcasts, the focus has been upon how to be successful with commercial property investing. And that's obviously what our listeners are striving towards. However, I thought it might be useful if today we could look at some of the potential risks and how to go about eliminating them. So, where's the best place to start?
Ken, I know everyone wants to eliminate risk, but the place to start is to understand that everything involves risk, whether it's buying commercial residential property, whether it's buying shares, even living life is a risk. And so it's not a matter of eliminating risks, it's a matter of eliminating unnecessary risks. And so that you need to take on what you might call is intelligent risks. And therefore, you gauge and quantify what the risk is and build it into your calculations and your methods of acquiring property, and so that you have some element of control over the risk that you take on. I mean, if you don't want any risk at all, the best thing is to put your money in the bank. Then, of course, you lose any capital growth. You just get interest on it. And so, again, you are running some risks that the value of your money will dissipate over time. So it's a balancing act. And so you need to, as I said, distinguish between necessary or intelligent risks and unnecessary and stupid risks.
Having made that distinction, what are some of the key steps you can take to help achieve this?
Okay, this is where it gets a little bit confusing, a sort of chicken and egg dilemma that people have, in that they feel that they can't really get good at doing commercial property investing unless they do lots of deals. But then how can they hope to do a good deal if or until they know a hell of a lot about commercial property investing? So I think we sort of touched on this, I think, in an earlier podcast. What you've got to do is you've got to look at lots of potential deals so that you get a confidence and feel about it. Then you also, after you've done that or while you're doing that, you need to realize that your preliminary negotiations with vendors are not binding. You're not committed until you actually sign a contract. And so therefore, knowing both those two things, what you need to do is make lots of offers on a regular basis. And we talked about that, I think, in the last thing. And you'll find your success ratio is going to be initially, as we said, I think, 10 to 1, 10 offers. And I'm not talking about repeated offers on the one property here. I'm talking about offers on individual properties. So it might take you 10 properties to start with before you actually get something that you conclude as a good deal. You know, my hit rate now is probably 2 to 1. So in other words, it only takes me a couple of properties on average, sometimes 3, sometimes 1, that I negotiate with or pick and choose that it's the correct property to conclude the deal. So it's probably those three elements that are going to help you learn the ropes, not have an exposure, because as I said, you're not bound until you actually sign a contract, and therefore build up your confidence and help you to identify what are reasonable risks and in the process eliminate or avoid some of those unnecessary risks.
Let's start with your first step. For most listeners, I suspect investing isn't their full-time activity. Therefore, couldn't looking at lots of deals become rather time consuming?
Yeah, you're right. Look, when you're starting out, even before you get to doing a financial analysis, it can be very time consuming because you tend to look at the properties, you get into a lot of depth, you get research information and so forth. And for the first one or two, that's probably the right way to go about it. But once you get a feel for the amount of information and the type of information that's provided by the selling agents, what I've done, and we've talked about this, I think, again in earlier podcasts, is I've provided a list of 8 investment objectives and 12 buying criteria that need to be satisfied before the property gets onto the short list and before you start making any offers or doing any further analysis. Now, if you do that manually, as some people have done in their own style and what have you, that can again be time consuming. So what I've did is to put together this app called the High Return Filter. And this enables you to very quickly, and once you understand it, you will probably, it'll only take you 5, maybe 10 minutes at the most to go through each property and quite objectively, as opposed to subjectively, analyze the pluses and minuses of a property, rate it very quickly. Now, what I'll do, Ken, is I'll give you a link. In fact, I'll get an image of the what you see on the iStore, and I'll put that for you on under the this podcast, so that if any of our listeners go to the propertybriefings.com website and go to this episode 42 on their iPad or iPhone, they can then go directly to the iStore and they'll be able to download it. Now, the app's completely free, and what it includes is 2 videos within the app itself, one just giving you a refresher course on how the investment objectives and buying criteria work to combine to give you the answer you need, and then another short video which explains and walks you through how to use the app, and so that you, as I said, very quickly in 5 or 10 minutes, you can quickly rate your properties. The reason I put those videos into the app is that so many apps that I get, you have to find your way around. Now, you know, while it might be intuitive, it can be, I mean, some weeks later you find out things that you can do with the app that if you'd only known on day one, it would have made your life so much easier. So that's why I've put in these walkthrough videos so that you can be up and running very, very quickly and can always refer back to it. And even while you're doing the analysis, I've got things where you can just double check what did that mean. While you might have seen it in the video, you can just touch the screen and it'll quickly flip over and say, the reason you're doing this is so-and-so, and this is how you should rate the property in relation to achieving this objective. So hopefully that'll answer it, and that will save our listeners a lot of time and effort when they're trying to just get the properties onto a short list that they can then take to the next stage.
Okay, so now you have a short list. Could you just explain your thinking behind the next 2 steps?
Well, the reason I'm suggesting that, as I said, you're making lots of offers and exploring properties is that you need the experience. Now, when you build up or talk to, as I do, a number of agents so that they know that you're in the market, they will send you deals. And the important thing is whether or not it's a deal that you're going to run with or not, it's important that you thank the broker or the real estate agent who sent it to you, who's acting for the vendor. But you want to have more information sent to you on an ongoing basis. So even if it doesn't fit your criteria, it's always good to go back to them and thank them. Just a short email thanking them very much. While it doesn't fit exactly what I'm after, this is the sort of details or criteria I need you to meet. Look forward to getting something from you down the track. So that sets you apart from most other people, because I can tell you that most selling agents, they'll send deals after deals, but they don't know who are the genuine people that are looking to put the deals together and to serious buyers. And so it's important to make yourself stand out. And just means, apart from being a professional courtesy, it just positions you as someone out of the pack. Now, even if some of the deals aren't close to what you want, you should still use them to practice your putting together your letters of offer and your purchase proposal. And I've explained the basis of doing that before. But by doing that, even if you get knocked back, again, you are seen by the selling agent as a serious purchaser. And it just helps you to refine it. I get the purchase proposals down, and there's a, while they're personally written, the format is there and it's easy to insert the information relative to the particular properties. So the whole concept here is, because you are not committed until you sign a contract, is to continue to make the offers. And sometimes it surprises you when you think you are a long way apart, but it may be that the vendor just hasn't got an offer. I mean, the selling agent is given instructions as to what he has got a quote as the asking price. And even though you might put in a lowball offer, you might be surprised how much the vendor comes down, because this is the first legitimate offer he might have had for 3 months. Now, there may be nothing wrong with the property. It's just that he's been off with the fairies as far as price is concerned. It might be that when he first went onto the market, there were a number of other properties, competing properties, that left him alone there. It got a bit stale. Again, quite often, that's the best time to catch a vendor, when it's 2 or 3 months after the property was first marketed, because he or she is really probably getting keen. You don't know the loan is falling due. It's going to cost them money to renegotiate it. They've got to get another valuation. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why circumstances change. And so by you making those proposals, you start to be able to read and gauge the feedback coming back as to how keen and sincere the vendor is about making a sale.
Presumably, you have already gone through the specific numbers for each property before submitting a formal proposal. How do you go about eliminating risk at that point?
Yeah, look, depending on the size of the property, you may not undertake a full-blown projected cash flow. I mean, if the property is, you know, in the 350 to 750 price bracket, it probably doesn't warrant it. But it doesn't mean you don't check the figures. Now, the vendors sometimes provide rubbery figures, or the agent does. They, if it's not fully leased, they might make projections of what it could be fully leased. So in other words, you've got to watch that the vendor isn't asking you to pay in advance for something that he or she hasn't done. In other words, tenant the property fully. Again, that depends on its size, whether you have multiple tenants. And other times, the property may be underlet, or it may be overlet. So it's working out whether the rent as stated represents an appropriate market figure. So again, it comes down to experience, looking at other properties, seeing what they are leased for, talking with other agents who may not be involved in the selling of the property as to what the property like that would be leasing for per square meter, and making allowance if there's a car park, how much that adds to it. so that you can very quickly build up a working knowledge of what the rent should be for the property. So you then know whether the property being offered is at market rent, and therefore in making a comparison or doing a calculation of the worth of the property, that you are using the appropriate capitalization rate. So those are the sort of things that you do need to look at before making any proposals.
What other aspects should you be considering?
What you might find is that the figures look good, but in actual fact, there is deferred maintenance, things that have been put off, and therefore you're going to run into pretty large expenses as the new owner, because the previous owner has been milking the property, taking the rent, but not really looking after the maintenance of it. It may be the property is a good property, but it's in the wrong area. It's just wrongly located for that type of use. So these are some of the things that you've got to look at. And if the property has been on the market for a long time, as I said, while that's not necessarily a bad thing, it could be, because if it has been priced correctly, why hasn't it sold? And it may be that people delving into it find there's some other impediment to the property than just the fact that it was overpriced. It may have some weakness. There may be some physical impediment to it, and therefore that's the reason it hasn't sold. So you just have to delve a little deeper.
How important is timing in all of this?
Obviously, timing is important. You need to know where you are in the local cycle. Now, as far as Melbourne is concerned, and probably Sydney to a degree, you're coming out of a dip. The dip in Melbourne was pretty slight compared to other capital cities with the global financial crisis. But you're going to have an upward swing in the market generally for commercial property, not so much for retail, but for offices and industrial, going through to probably 2018, 2019. So where you are in the cycle, are there any new projects being built in the area? You need to look at that, or could they be built? So in other words, that's going to affect supply. But you can get information, as we've discussed before, and normally in my blog I try and keep you up to date with the supply and demand that's going on. So, you know, it's just a matter of common sense. Is there vacant land nearby that, you know, more property could be built on? Things like that. Are there changes in the zoning going through? It's just a matter of being aware of the environment and tapping into that market intelligence.
So how would you like to summarise to today's discussion about risk?
Well, when it comes to commercial property, you've basically got three risks. You've got a business risk, which comes or is related to making poor business decisions. In other words, it comes down to your judgment and how you make decisions, not only in buying, but in the ownership and the management of the property. And that comes down to experience, and that's where your consulting team can certainly help out. Then you have things like financial risk, and that relates to the funds you borrow on the property. Are you over-leveraged? Have you got an exposure? I generally suggest people keep a funds aside of at least 2 or 3 months' interest payments, just in case the rent doesn't come in for whatever reason. And your final risk is what you call an insurable risk. And this is making sure that you have the physical coverage of the property if anything were to go wrong. And I'm talking about disasters, fire, flood, all that sort of stuff. So you need to do that, and you take advice on that as well. So if you cover all those risks, you can cover your intelligent risks, and you're not going to take any stupid risks in the process of buying your properties.
I think it's so important to have a balanced picture when it comes to commercial property investing. And therefore, on behalf of our listeners, I'd like to thank you, Chris, for providing these rather valuable insights.
Look, I just hope it was helpful in rounding out their understanding.